Hi. We just found this cat, and we're looking for the owner.
Yeah, it's mine.
He seems to hate you. Are you sure?
Yeah, it's my cat. Give me my cat.
Now, wait a minute. What's his name?
Bob Buttons.
Bob Buttons?
Uh-huh. Bob Buttons. Here, Bob Buttons.
You are a very bad man.
You owe me a cat.
And what is happening, everyone? Welcome on in to the Check Your Brain podcast. I am on location as I do this. Normally, I do it outside of my humble abode in Cleveland, Ohio, but I am in South Florida right now with surface of Mercury sunburns right now. So I've got my sunglasses on. If you are watching on the YouTube page, I've got my bucket hat on. I'm very Florida. I've got my palm trees on my Hawaiian shirt. So I'm living the life right now as I'm on vacation. And normally when people go on vacation, they don't want to work. They don't want to do it. Like I've got podcasts, but you know what? I'm done. I'm getting away from it, enjoying myself. But when I had an opportunity to talk to this gentleman, I'm like, this is going to be a vacation for me. I'll get into that here in 1 second. Let me get the plugs out of the way first. Again, my podcast is the Check Your Brain podcast. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it on the major podcast platforms. And if you want more information, more content from me, early access to guests like Larry here, is go to my Patreon at patreon.com/TonyMazur for $3, $5, and $10 a month. Get different tiers and different content. And eventually I'll have merchandise and everything like that. But if you don't want to spend your money on me, how about you spend it on my guest this week, Larry Hankin. Larry is the author of a book, That Guy, A Cautionary Memoir. And if you don't know who Larry Hankin is, shame on you. And also the second part to that is, yes, you do know who he is because he is that guy. You've seen him in everything. He's been in every movie. He's been in every TV show. We'll talk about all those. For folks who like my generation grew up with Larry, with Billy Madison of playing Carl. You played the Kramer character in Seinfeld. You were in Friends, Breaking Bad. You were also in a ton of movies. We'll get into all those. But before I get to all that, hi, Larry. Good to have you on the podcast.
Bill, I think Eric is up to something.
Who's Eric?
Oh, he works for my dad, too. He gets the company if I screw up. He's a douchebag.
He made some menacing comments to me earlier today, and then he did that little weasel laugh that he does.
Oh, yeah. How's that laugh go again?
You know.
Yeah, it's very good. It sounded just like him.
Thanks. Well, I'm sure he's got some.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Larry, how you been? I mean, you know, you've been a working actor for so many years, and you're still doing it. You're still plugging away. You are still hard at doing the craft that is acting.
Well, that's a little not accurate. I'm laying back for. I'm on an extended vacation. Let's put it that way.
That's what I'm saying right now.
Well, yeah, no. Right now, I'm just doing podcasts and writing. Podcasts and writing. That's what I'm doing now. Yeah. Acting gets a little old. After a while. So I just like, you know, I'm trying to lay back and just get used to being a normal person.
In an abnormal world.
Well, yeah, that makes it even harder. But yeah, I just I'm trying to learn to play guitar, and that seems to be very interesting to me at the moment.
Well, so it's funny what you said about acting and that you're kind of tired of it or whatever the business kind of leaves different people. But as a character actor, you're always working. And I just saw a recent clip of Ernie Hudson, who was in, of course, Ghostbusters and a bunch of other movies. And he said, I'm sure everybody thinks I'm this multimillionaire, has this huge house in Palisades or right in Malibu overlooking the ocean. He's like, I'm a working actor. He's like, I'm not struggling, but you have to keep it going. And as a character actor, as a working actor, it's something that there's plenty of jobs. It's just, it's not the $20 million a year picture.
Well, yeah. And also a couple of years back, either I, I didn't retire, but I dropped out and I told my agents that. I said, no, don't send me out for a while. I just want to cool it. So either they thought I was retiring and I assumed they were retiring, but somehow they retired. And I thought, well, that sounds like a good thing. I mean, in other words, I didn't get replacements. I just said, okay, I don't have any agents anymore. And probably the jobs will, you know, kind of dwindle off. And that sounded okay to me because not working and not running around either auditioning or getting into weird costumes or fighting with directors or costume persons. I just said, you know, let me try writing. So I wrote that guy, and that seemed to work out fine. I mean, people like it, and it's pretty good, actually. Turns out I can write. So I'm writing another one now called Loopholes, and that's not about me or show business. It's just stories. It's fiction.
Okay.
Memoirs are, I didn't know this. I just wrote what I knew, which was me, and I called it that guy. But it turns out that memoirs are the least big sellers. In other words, in the declination of books being sold. Yeah, memoirs, I guess it's a specialized genre, I guess. I mean, I haven't talked to anybody about it, but
it seems like maybe a memoir is one of those. It gets a big first week and it drops off. Like you do the Today Show, you do radio shows and podcasts, and then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, the book's 2 weeks old, whatever. It's that's old. We're talking about some other character actor has a new book or whatever. But
because I think that's what people do in my business, is they write a memoir when they're not working as much, because you can't do anything else. I mean, acting is a dead end. I mean, it is. It just, at a certain point, you can be the greatest character actor in the world. It really doesn't matter. There's a cutoff point. And for different people, it's different ages, but it comes, whatever age it comes at. Some it comes when you're, well, for women, it's sooner. They become TV moms. That's
yes,
and that's like women don't like that. I mean, that they have to, or just, you know, become some other job. You know,
Look at Clint Howard, for example. Clint Howard, part of, you know, Ron Howard's brother. And oh, he's going to be in. He's in these TV shows. He's a cute little kid, and as he gets older and realizes. Let's just say I'm not George Clooney here, so I'm probably going to end up having to find my way. So you either have two ways. You either drop out of acting, or you go, okay, maybe I will be the side character in this to help along a project. And he's been in so many big movies. It's just, he may not be the star, but there has to be that realization if you're an actor of that sort. And it's got to be really tough if you're, like you said, a female, that you have to just say, look, I can't, I'm not the A-list hot blonde that everybody wants me to be. I have to be mom. I have to be grandma. I have to do this. There's some who have done it very well. I know Julie Haggerty has done a great job of transitioning to that level. Mary Steenburgen, who I had the pleasure of meeting a few years ago, she's done that as well. And it's like, who are our moms that we need in a Will Ferrell movie or something? And sure enough, they give them a call. So yeah, it's got to be definitely tough, but it's a grind.
I guess all jobs end up, period. All jobs end, you know what I mean? But with acting, it's just so specialized, you know, just memorize lines in front of a camera. First of all, it sounds very easy, which it isn't. And second of all, there's a method to it. So you have to learn stuff to do it. And there's no use for it in any other job. You know, you have to, I mean, even selling shoes, there's no translation. or whatever, or digging ditches or anything else. Whereas I guess that happens with if you're a ditch digger. I mean, at some point you just can't lift a shovel anymore, but it doesn't translate into another job. So I guess all of them kind of peter out. And when my agents retired, both of them retired, I thought, well, maybe I should too, or at least drop out. I still work for friends. You know, they call me, hey, would you do this? But, you know, I can now have requirements, you know, on my end instead of their end. You know, well, you have to be this, you have to be that. You have to be fat, you have to be skinny. You should be this, you should be. I decided, no, I'm gonna start making demands. Like, no, nah, too many words. Too many words. Because it's for me, I have dyslexia, so it's really hard to memorize lines. I do it, you know, but it takes a longer time. So that comes into the equation. Sometimes, when I stopped, right before I dropped out, I could make that demand and they would help me out. You know, they'd say, well, send him the script first, you know, the finished script first, so he has time. And it always worked out. But sometimes it didn't work out. Or sometimes I didn't know, it's just too many words. I don't think I can memorize it in time. So, yeah. And I thought, yeah, you know, it's becoming a bother to be an actor. It wasn't a wow anymore. It was a bother. And,
I was gonna say because you being an actor and having you're talking about memorizing lines, but you're not like a normal actor who came from the stage and you have text and you go here and you're acting in a TV show and this and there's text. You started in comedy. And when you start in comedy, especially improv comedy, it's yes and. It's you got to keep going. You got to keep going. You're for folks who don't know, Larry, you started in Second City. You worked with Solins. You worked with Sills. You worked with all those people in the early days and then went out to San Francisco as part of the committee. So you're talking about you're coming up with characters in your own material. Then you get into a business where the characters are created for you and the text is created for you. Was there a frustration in your early days where you wanted to create and you wanted to improvise, you wanted to put your own lines, and then you had a director say, yeah, I get your improv background, but you see, we have a text here and we wrote this and we have a bunch of writers, so can you please read the text?
Yeah, that's most of the arguments I've had. In the beginning, they finally give up. You go, all right, fine, whatever you say. And then after that, there's the third stage, which is, no, I know better than you. Directors don't like that, so I stopped doing that. But I had my way of, well, you know, to take your point, that's what I discovered. If I stick to it and use my improv experiences and the creation of characters as opposed to given a character, it did me in good stead to what they would call quirky. I would make the character just because I would relax in the role, you know. My training as an improv actor would come to the surface of me memorizing lines. So what it would do, it would make a very unique, you know, bend to the character that I'm doing and memorizing lines and was written for me.
It's pretty natural too.
Well, I guess it's natural. I mean, I never, you know, I don't examine what I do too much, but what should be done, you know, being
well, because as a comic, because I do stand up as well, and when you're a part of something where you do have a text, it's a lot of it's the natural reaction. So if you are somebody who is naturally funny and you have someone on the set where you can kind of break up a little bit, that you're getting a natural reaction, a natural laugh, a natural just any type of emotion, it seems, that you won't necessarily get from people who are just straight. I'm a thespian. It feels that it would be one of those cases that, again, I don't know. I didn't make the plunge out to Hollywood, but I do see this when it comes to something between a stand-up comedy set and just a funny one-man show that's been well-crafted, I guess.
Well, I've had three stages and three different kinds of show business. The first was I started out as a stand-up comedian, and that was in the coffee houses. And that was it was fast. In other words, I'm a good fast learner, but it was difficult getting a handle on what I was doing. So in other words, what I'm saying is when I started as a stand-up comedian, I was not very funny. I just, for some reason, because here's the difference. When you're making your friends laugh, that's one kind of funny. And I was a funny guy in high school and college. I would just diss everything in a funny way. And a lot of people didn't like it, but a lot of people thought it was funny. But getting on a stage, because I thought, well, I'm a funny guy. I can do it better than him or her. That was my impetus. That was my instinct. So I got up on a coffee house stage, and it wasn't funny at all. I mean, when people, even if they pay just for a coffee and sit there waiting for their friend to go on, because it was open mic night, that's different than making your friends laugh. There's just a different vibe on the stage and from the audience. So it took me a while, for me, 6 months of not getting any laughs. Or if I did, they were, you know, I wouldn't do it again. Yeah, I got laughs, but I can do better.
Just 6 months. I've gone 10 years and haven't made someone laugh. What's going on? Am I in the wrong business? No, I'm just kidding.
Maybe. It could be, but you just got to keep doing it until you get it, or you get tired of doing it and you're not getting it. But if it takes you 10 years or 20 years or 5 minutes, some people just get on the stage and they're funny. I mean, that killed me to see somebody who I never saw before, you know, get on the stage and just kill. You go, wow, man. Well, mainly it's just being relaxed, and you know, and you got to be able to relax on the stage, and then you're halfway there. So I learned, but I did learn after 6 months, and then I got a manager, and he was booking me around, and I was, you know, getting on planes and flying in nightclubs all over the place. And I got tired of it. First of all, I discovered Richie Pryor and George Carlin and Lenny Bruce. And that's where I headed, you know, in my work. In my genre ship. And I was divided. In other words, sometimes I would, you know, kill, and sometimes nothing. I mean, I've had people come, well, two kinds of people. I've had people come out of the audience with beer bottles saying, get that F off the stage. That's weird, man. Now, that happened several times, and I started to see there's a pattern here. And sometimes I wouldn't, you know, no reaction at all. And then sometimes I get like a standing go. I would be doing arena shows. You know, I was traveling with Love and Spoonful on their U.S. tour. I was the opening act. So, okay, so that's one, the stand-up. And then when I couldn't take the cops pulling me off the stage, that was
one content
too far. What?
So was it for content? Because there's, of course, the old Lenny Bruce story where he would have the overcoat on, and he'd have his legal papers and stuff like that, just because they knew as soon as he gets off stage, he's going to get pulled over and he's going to get arrested.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Only I wasn't as famous as Lenny Bruce, but I think it was the same cops. And I played Washington University, I guess, in St. Louis, Missouri. Big, about 2,000 seat house. And in the middle of my act, first the audience, they started to laugh because, you know, you have clean stuff, you have off color stuff, you just mix it up. It doesn't matter. There's a thread, you know, you're telling us some sort of a arc. And I noticed that they would laugh really cool at this part, and they wouldn't like that part. And then they said the audience started getting restless. And in one part where there wasn't any laughs, they kept on yelling, "Do the funny stuff, do the funny stuff." And I was like, that's an insult. I took it as an insult. Oh, screw you. I'm doing what I want to do. You're here because you want to be here. So you can leave. I mean, that was my attitude. But then they kept on saying, and then the audience kept on chanting, "Do the funny stuff, do the," because the funny stuff worked, man. It's just you mix it up. Okay. So I just did some funny stuff for a while and I got them back and they were laughing. So I thought, okay, back to the weird stuff, the quirky stuff. And man, they just shut right up. And then I see on the back 20 policemen marching up the wall aisles and up onto the stage. And I just stopped and they stopped. They just froze when the cops came, the audience, entire audience, just shut up. There was just silence. And that's what caught my attention. And I go, what's going on? And I see these cops moving up. So I just stood there waiting because, I was following Lenny Bruce. I knew the dance.
Oh,
So
yeah.
I just stopped and I waited for them to come up. And I don't think they knew why they were pulling me off the stage. Later, I heard that the dean of the college was in the back. And when the first time I started to do the illegal stuff, he called the police. But when they finally arrived, 10, 15 minutes, whatever, they stood in the back because I had gone back into the clean stuff. So then the dean told them to, no, wait, he cleaned it up. Wait. So I didn't know that, but they were all piled up in the back. I
Wow.
couldn't see that far. And when I, switched because the audience started to die and I switched into clean, no, I thought I was getting them back. So I switched into the illegal stuff and boom, I see this guy and he says, go, Dean, go. And so I only did like about 4 or 5 minutes of the illegal, the cursing.
Of course. How dare you?
How dare I?
Well,
But
tell if you can, because I would love to. You and I talked about this off the air, but the Kent State story is also a classic as well.
what?
You
Oh, the
perform in
Kent
Kent
State.
State. Yep.
And what I don't remember. You got to be more specific.
That you had performed there. That of course, May 4th, 1970, when the National Guard came in, shot four people, four dead in Ohio, and then apparently you had gone there as a comic the next week or very recently after, and that there was a specific mandate that you can't even mention any, don't mention ROTC, don't mention Governor Rhodes, don't mention what happened at Kent State, don't do any of that. And you told me a story about how that you just said, yeah, whatever, I'm just going to do my act and do whatever.
Well, I think I know what you're talking about. I didn't realize it was Kent State at the time because we were traveling. So that's the other thing about traveling with a band. The entire itinerary was up to them, and they were paying for the hotel, they were paying for the plane. So, and it's a very closed-in unit. It was the five of us and two managers, their two managers. And they booked us from what I just told you, the cops were pulling me off the stage. So we became a very, I don't know what you call it, very enclosed. We didn't, I wasn't reading newspapers. I knew about Kent State, but I didn't know we were going to Kent State. I just, oh, we're going to another one. All right, fine. Just get on the plane, blah, blah, blah. All we wanted to know was where was the hotel and where can I get some sleep? That was basically, where's my room? That was all you wanted to know. And where's the venue? How far are we? And how long do we have? So we got there, and the first sign of what you're talking about is when we got off the plane. And there was a car waiting for us. They phoned ahead. We're a band. We're going to the college, Washington, D.C. They drove us there and they dropped us off at the hotel. And then it began. We walk in, and after we signed in, we started to walk towards the elevators, and our way was blocked. The five of us and the two managers, we were walking in a unit together. And there was a priest in the full white collar thing, a police officer in uniform with a cap. He wasn't like a street policeman, cop. He was some sort of official, you know, chief or something.
Captain, yeah.
And a guy, captain. And a guy in a suit, a gentleman in a suit, and gray hair. And he was the dean of the college. And they said, is there a Larry Henkin in this group? And the two managers understood immediately what was going on, because they stepped in front of the five of us, you know, whoomp like that. And they spoke to these guys and they turned around to us, the two managers, blocking the three of them. And they said very quietly, and he put his hand up like this, one of the managers, so that they couldn't see who he was pointing to. And he said, I want you guys to go up to Larry's room, lock the door, and don't let anybody in but us. Go. And then he turned around and then they just started talking to these guys, these three uniformed men. And we got up in the room. They go, this is my room. They locked the door. And now the loving spoonful started to dun me. They sat me on the bed and they said, you got to do your stuff, man. You got to do your stuff. You got to. What they were saying is, you got to be pulled off the stage and start a riot, because we need the people. So that was what was going on. And I'm saying, no, man, this is my career. What are you talking about? No, you know, I'm not going to do that. You know, I'll do clean stuff. Because I didn't know what was going on. I was a very naive kid. And no, you got to do it. You got to do it, man. And one of them said, probably Zali, said, hey, wait a minute. If he goes out there and he does his dirty stuff, they're going to shut down the concert and it's going to cost us. We may not be able to get booked again. I mean, what's going on with him is going to reflect on us. Well, no, he can't do it. Don't. Just don't go on. If you don't want to do, just don't go on. We'll do the whole thing. And at that point, I thought, no, you know, I kind of want to do my illegal stuff. So I said, okay, I'm going to do my stuff. I'm just going to do my act and that's it. And then the knock on the door, and who is it? And it's the two managers. And they come in, they say, okay, Larry, you can't go on. They said if Larry goes on, they're going to shut down the concert. And then the Lovin' Spoonful says, Larry, you got to go on now. You got to go on, man. And that all four of them were just, yeah, this is great. They were just dancing around. And I was kind of happy too. In other words, I wanted to see what would happen. Because again, I was naive. I didn't have any money if it was going to go to court or anything. I didn't have any money for lawyers, but I thought, let's just do it. So I did it, and nothing. I went on, started open with my clean stuff, and then just did my act that I've been doing for, you know, the last year. And the cops pulling me off the stage and everything. Nothing. The dean was in the back, the cops were in the back, and the show went without a hitch. For me, the audience laughed all the way through everything. In other words, there wasn't silence or do the funny stuff. So it was a mystery to at least the dean and the cop and the priest. And they said, well, the dean said, let him go. It's not that bad. And I go, wow. And then we just did the rest of the tour with no hitches at all. So that Washington University thing was kind of a weirdness. It was not what was going on in the United States in colleges. Oh, because here's one of the things. Before the cops pulled me off the stage at Washington University, yeah, there's one thing that I thought was really cool, and that was they would quiet down when I did the illegal stuff, and they shut up. Basically, they shut up, no reaction at all. And then if I went to the clean stuff, laughter, blah blah blah. So finally, right before the cops pulled me off the stage, they quieted down. The cops didn't show up yet. They quieted down. And I got really pissed because, hey, this stuff works. I mean, that was going on in my head. This stuff works. Well, what's wrong with them? There's something wrong with them. So they said, do the funny stuff, do the funny stuff. Because I stopped. I stopped. They stopped reacting. And I just, and then they started yelling, do the funny stuff, do the funny stuff. And I just became Larry Hankin. And I go, hey, what do you mean do the funny stuff? This is funny stuff. And they shut up, man. And they said, and I kept on excoriating them, I guess is the word. Said, well, what do you mean? Why, this is funny stuff. What do you mean do the funny stuff? I am doing the funny stuff. I mean, this is a college, right? You're college people, and you don't think this is funny? I'm just, and they just quieted down. They just shut right up. They didn't answer me or anything. And I said, okay, let's just go on. I'll do funny stuff for a while, and then I'm going back and I'm doing it. I don't care what you people say. I mean, I was just, and they took it, man. I mean, especially when I said, you people are college people. You should be grown up. You should be laughing at this stuff. This is a college.
That's amazing. And how much had
That.
changed in that time that you had started doing comedy to the time when you got heavy into acting, is that you went from being way more conservative type of audiences and the material had to be clean. You couldn't say, like, there were a lot of areas that had the rules that you couldn't cross vulgarity lines, to the point where by the time you're getting into acting, it's now F words and smoking pot and drugs and everything. And
It was
it really
starting. It
changed
was,
in that time.
well, that was what I was expecting, is that the people who come to see the Lovin' Spoonful or any of the touring bands smoke marijuana. Every audience, I figured, if they're in an arena type of show and it's a touring band, they got hits, on
Do
the
you believe in magic? That kind of stuff. Yeah.
Or any of the other bands, especially the Grateful Dead, but and even those bands, if you went to their concert, at least half the audience smoked marijuana, but nobody was talking about it. It wasn't legal yet, so that was this conservative kind of veneer over everything. And then finally, when it became legal and blah blah blah, then boom, you could you then everybody was doing Lenny Bruce stuff and George Carlin and Pryor, but they had managers backing them up and on the tour because their bands were the ones that were famous, and whereas I was an opening act, so they didn't know who I was. I was just this funny guy for most of the tour. And then there was these pockets of what the fuck? He's cursing on stage. What is that? So that was the end of that. I thought at the end of the so at the end of that tour, of Lovin' Spoonful, where I had a full on hit of what was expected, no cursing on the tour on any tour, so. I called my manager and I said, okay, no more of that kind of stuff. Just book me in nightclubs. Nightclubs, they accepted, not because they smoked marijuana, but because they were grown-ups, you know, they drinking liquor and they didn't mind, you know, me cursing or whatever.
So because nowadays, if you don't usually see an act that goes up anymore that has a comedian that opens for them. I saw Barry Manilow a number of years ago, and I think it was Dov Davidoff, who's a very funny comic, but it's a tough room because everyone's going to see the main act. And when you have a comic that's going up there and saying, so how about this Viagra, everybody? And it's people usually getting drinks. They're finding their seat. They're moving around. They're talking to their neighbor. It's a tough gig. Another friend of mine who worked with Diana Ross up in Detroit, and it was the same situation. They're not there to see the comic. Even if it's a comic they actually really enjoy, they're not there to see the comic. So even I can't even imagine what it would be like if you're a big Love and Spoonful fan or some of those Woodstock era acts that you got to work with back in the day, and you get to see Larry Hankin. Now, you could be the funniest guy, but if you're somebody who's been loaded up in the parking lot on LSD marijuana and whatever, the last thing you want to hear is, so some weather we're having today.
Well, it wasn't quite like that. In those days, if you were opening for a rock band, a popular rock band, no, they got there on time and they listened. I never had people doing what you were saying. It became when you were a single. See, the people that you said, they were singles and they were nightclub acts. No, I'm just talking about music.
Okay.
Bands. That was it. They had, they stopped opening with musical rock acts. In other words, if it was Grateful Dead, they had a rock band opening for them. If the Love and Spoonful was the concert heads, they had a rock band opening for them. They stopped that. And they were one of the first to say, we don't want a rock band anymore. They told me, because I said, what do you mean? I didn't understand that. You want a comedian to open for you? And they said, yeah, I think it's much better. So they insisted, and I got, well, okay. And it worked out. And then the other rock band started to open with comedians. And that was like the way it went for about a year. And then I don't know what happened because I left that blah, blah, blah. And I just, and then I opened after the Spoonful show, I opened for, what is it called? Four guys, singers. It was a group, very, very popular. I can't remember their name anymore. Kingston Trio.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The Kingston. So I was opening for the Kingston Trio in a nightclub called something Jay's on the Highway outside of Boston. And that was the first time where I opened for a nightclub act. And that's when a guy came at me with a beer bottle and said, get the fuck off the stage.
Wow.
And he was, and it was, thank God it was, you know, nightclubs have dance floors. And thank God it was a big dance floor, because that's when he came out of the, because you can't see, you know, the lights are in your eyes, you can't see. But he came into the light, because the dance floor was lit. That's how much the light leaked out from the stage across the dance floor. So I heard from the audience in the blackness, they said, get off the stage. I just kept going. I said, get off the stage. I just kept going. And then I see this guy come into the light and he's walking across the dance floor. He's got a fucking beer bottle upside down in his fist. And he's saying, I said, get off the stage. And he kept walking towards me. And I just, as he's walking towards me, I just faded. Standing there with a beer bottle in his hand in the light going, all right. And he went and he marched back. I sat down at the bar and the bartender comes over and he says, what are you going on? He didn't get back on the stage, you know? I said, I'm not going. Did you see that guy come at me with a beer bottle? And he said, I don't care what he came at you with. Get back on the stage. You got 10 more minutes. The Love and Spoonful, the Kingston Trio aren't ready to go on. And I said, I'm not going on. And if you don't tell that guy to either shut up or kick him out. And he said, you either get on that stage or you're fired. And I said, I'm not going out there. And he said, you're fired. I said, no, I quit. And then I walked out. And I walked down into a snowstorm. It was the middle of the winter in Boston. Man, it was coming down and I'm trying to flag a cab and it was awful. So that was, okay, that was the end of that era. I said, I called my agent. I said, nope, no more stand-up. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm not doing this. I can't take the heat. So I see, and George Carlin and Richie Pryor had agents or managers who would stand up for them and say, no, you got to keep going. You got to fight this stuff. You know, we'll, you know, back you. And I don't know, lawyers, they had lawyers, they had backup. I had none. So my manager said, why don't you join Second City? They do the same thing as Pryor, but they own the theater, so they'll throw that guy out. And then he says, besides, their stage is 3 feet high. He'd have to climb up on the stage, which gives you time to get away. And besides, there's four other people on the stage, and they can fight this guy with you. So I thought, okay, that sounds cool. So that's what I did. I auditioned for Second City, and they shipped me to St. Louis with the cops. But we were in a nightclub, and we were booked for, I think, 3 months. So, yeah.
Who did you work with?
What?
Who did you work with during those days?
Martin Levitt is the only name that comes to mind. And a female who was a method actor, and oh, that was hard because, you know, she had to have a backstory. Even though she's making up the character, we had to help her with her backstory to whatever character she came up with, and she would only do certain scenes, you know. No, I don't want to do this. You know, so and then if we said, okay, fine, we started to leave her out. We wouldn't choose, you know, hey, would you do this scene with me? Nobody would go near her. So she complained to the director. So we had to, now we were forced to, you got to go with, I can't remember her name. And who else can do I, Martin Levitt stood out because he was just quirky himself. He was just a quirky human being. And when he went up on a stage and whatever he did, it didn't matter. He was funny in front, a priori, just him walking on stage and you started to laugh. And there was no reason. We could not figure it out, you know, why he was funny, but he just was. I guess whatever character he chose was quirky like him. So everybody thought, oh, he's making that up. No, that's him off stage. We deal with that every day.
Because that's the thing. And so this predates a lot of what a lot of people remember of that era of Second City, the, you know, Catherine O'Hara, Eugene Levy, the, you know, Chicago and the Toronto.
It was right before, who was the guy who got on SNL at, you know, the
Dan Aykroyd?
Who?
Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah, and his buddy, Dan Aykroyd and
John Belushi.
Belushi. Yeah, I was the one right before that. The actors before that. I came right after she had a TV show too. I can't remember people's names that far back. It was so far back. But you know, Anthony Holland, they became, you know, famous actors. Some were character actors, some were Alan Arkin. He was in the company before me, and then Belushi was the company after me, and I was in the middle of that.
You really are the bond to everything in show business. You really have that Forrest Gump feel that you've been around this, and the fact that Second City can move on, then eventually they get the TV show in the 70s and very popular in the 80s, and all the groups, and the fact that Second City's there to this day, you needed those early classes, those early groups to get through it, and you were a part of it. It's incredible.
Well, yeah, and also I just got tired of what I was doing. Like the being a stand-up comic. I mean, George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, Richie Pryor, they had the fire in the belly, man. You couldn't stop them from being a comedian if you set them on fire, which Pryor did.
Literally.
But I didn't have that. I mean, if it got too weird, I just say, "Hey, man, I'm out of here." I just didn't need it. That was my excuse. Yeah, hey, I don't need this. No, screw this. And anyway, I was just living on the road. I was this, that, and the other thing. So my expenses were very small, and whatever I was being paid as a stand-up comedian, either arena shows or nightclubs, was enough to get me by and have a little left over for fun, and I wasn't doing any drugs at all during this entire time. I never
Wow.
did anything. I didn't get into drugs until I hit San Francisco on the committee. I
Well, there you go.
was a
And
late bloomer. I was a late bloomer.
talk about the
Anything?
committee, because that's
Anything?
another influential group for people that again, Second City comes out of
Started
Chicago and Toronto, but out in the West Coast, you had that group and it became massive.
Oh yeah, we were as big as Second City. And me and about five other people and a director, all from Second City, just went out there, and we, as the stand-up people say, we killed. We had lines around the block. I'm not talking about lines down to the end of the block. I'm talking about lines around the block. I mean, there's certain things about my career that I thought, wow, that's amazing. I mean, like me stopping and just like excoriating the audience in Washington, D.C., just stopping and just forget any, show business, what do you call it? Pretense. I just was Larry, just like, hey, man, I know this is funny. You should be laughing. And then having the cops pull me off the stage. Well, I said, hey, I know the dance. Thank you. They were gonna, they put their hands on my shoulders, and were trying to, and I said, I'm going, I'm going, I'm going. There was no resistance. So they just walked with me. That's what I said. They don't know why they're pulling me off the stage. I mean, because they didn't hear the illegal stuff. They just saw the start of it. He was pretty funny because they were laughing at the clean stuff. That was a weird thing.
Well,
So
by
why
the
would
time you
you?
get by the time you get to Second City and the committee, was it because again, with what we saw on the television shows, and then eventually a lot of the Groundlings and a lot of them ended up in, and the Lemmings went on to Saturday Night Live and other shows, is that and National Lampoon's Radio Hour and the whole National Lampoon gang. There's a lot of like innuendo, there's a lot of stuff, but was the stage show as dirty or was it as clean as what you saw on television? Were you getting a
Okay,
little bit more?
no, it was okay. This is what they pulled me off the stage, the cops, at St. Louis. The key kickoff that the dean said, "Okay, get him," was I said, "Okay, let's talk about religion now."
Uh-oh.
So that was I noticed a shift in the room, the vibe. But I had done this, a million times before, so just kept going. Let's talk about religion. Okay. Now, here's a little human being. And I put him on the mic stand. I put him on the top of the mic and go, okay, so there's a little human being. And I said, and I'm God. And then I heard a whoa, whoa. I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. And then I go, where's your clothes? You're naked. Let's put on some clothes. And what's that thing between your legs? Boom, that was it. That was it. What's that
Get him,
thing
get him.
between your legs? And they didn't want to hear what it was. I said, what is it? And I saw the cops. I said, because they were keyed when I said, let's talk about religion. So they were ready. And they got, so, I mean, that's how weird those times were. You never mind cursing on stage. You couldn't say the word religion. It's like now.
True. Yeah.
So, I saw the cops, and that's when I stopped. Now, generally I said, I didn't say the word, for what, I don't know if you can curse on your thing. It's all.
Yeah. Fuck it. Say whatever you want.
Yeah. Okay. So I said, you know, that's not your dick or your dong or whatever it was, or your whatever. I would say it. So I didn't even say it, figuring, well, maybe I could wheedle around it. But it was thinking, and, you know, and fuck, and, you know, the seven words that, you know, through all that stuff. In other words, that hunk of Carlin's came from somewhere.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
You know, but he had been to court, and I couldn't afford it. So that was one of the weirdnesses of what was legal and what was illegal or raunchy or whatever. So when I went into second, when we broke and went to the committee, that was the second stage of my show business career, improv. And I was there for 10 years. I loved it. I would still be there. I don't care how much money I wasn't getting. I loved the art of it, the experience of it, the doing of it. It was, I just loved it. You couldn't keep me out of that. You couldn't keep me off the stage just improvising. And we owned the theater, and we had started it, me and the other people in my company. So we took pride in what we were doing. Because it was ours. We started from scratch. We started from don't quit your day gig. You know, nobody would come. Here's the rule. This is where we started. If there was more people in the audience than on the stage, we didn't have to do a show. So if we got only six people in the audience, we didn't have to do a show. And we started to make that as a rule. I mean, sometimes, you know, there was only like six or five people in the audience, and the director would come back and say, yeah, we gave them their money back and forget it. And not enough people. So, okay. And then that became a rule. We would just ask the waitresses, because we would wait in the kitchen to go on. We didn't have a room for ourselves.
You didn't have the green room, yes.
We didn't have a green room. We waited in the kitchen. There was five chairs in the kitchen. And so we asked the waitress, how many people you got out there? And they'd say, seven. And we go, oh, man, we have to do a show. You know, that was the rule. So we did a show for seven people. And that went on for months. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I guess the reviews, they didn't even bother to review our shows in the beginning. And nobody showed up, so it didn't matter. But then the Examiner and I guess the San Francisco Chronicle gave us rave reviews about 6 months into it. And boom, all of a sudden, lines around the block, and it never stopped. I mean, the weekends, the Friday and Saturday show, you probably couldn't buy a ticket.
And, you know, incredible. And the fact that you were doing that.
They closed after 10 years. I was willing to go the distance, and I did. I was in the opening show, and I was in the closing show. So I just loved it. And we started to get raises because we were doing so well. So, you know, and we became famous in San Francisco. And I was famous in San Francisco, as was the rest of the group. You know, we were doing a lot of radio shows and, you know, stand up for this, you know, group and opening this and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so when the 10 years were over and the committee closed, because everybody in the first two companies, there were two companies during that 10 years, all of them got hired, including me, to go down there. So they would go down there, make a pile of money, and come back and go get back in the show, because that's how you can work in improv. Somebody else would just improv your part, you know, and yep. If they change it and you come back, too bad it's this now, because the director would set it, and they would put it in the set show. there was a set show, and how they did it was you improvise it, then you work on it in the improv section, and then you move it into the freeze it, lock it, it works, it's great, and you like that. You just, so that's how the show changed, you know, you just go like that. So after 10 years, I didn't have the committee anymore, and I didn't know what to do, so I didn't, there was nothing to come back to, so I just went down there, do a show.
Down to L.A.
Down to Hollywood.
Yeah.
L.A. Yeah. And you, and I just, you know, struggled and started to, because I didn't know anything else except showbiz. I never got another job.
You didn't think about trying to get into comedy? Like when you had that comedy boom in the 1980s, you didn't think maybe I should go back on stage? Or were you like, nah, I'm past that point?
No, I was past that point. I don't want to go back on the stage. I was there to be an actor, because of the salaries. And there was no comparison between an improv theater, you know, salary, and you know, one.
Yeah, you don't want to get paid in free drink tickets.
Yeah. Well, no,
I can't pay you tonight, but I got a free meal for you. Yeah, okay, that makes up for the 45 minutes up front.
No, we never got into that. We always made, well, once, in other words, when we were only getting 5 or 6 people, the first 6 months was a struggle, but no, we were getting a salary. In other words, when Alan Meyerson decided to leave Second City with 5 people, he went to San Francisco with his wife first because they fired him. Oh, they let him go, and they just let you go. He flew to San Francisco with his wife, and they raised enough money to go for a year to build a theater. You know, it was a bocce ball court, an indoor bocce ball court.
Oh, wow.
Transposed it into a theater, a 500-seat theater. And that was ours. And they had raised money to do that, transform it into a theater, and pay 5 actors for a year at $200 a piece. So we never got that, because we said, we're not, you pay us a salary until you can't afford that. And then we quit. So no. But by the time we closed, we were making, I don't know, $500, $600 a week. And that was pretty good money for those days for a stage show. But that's because we were a hit. But anyway, I left that and went to Hollywood. And then there's just so many people. There's not that many people who want to be improvisers. So the competition is not that great. But to be an actor, man, that's a whole other scene. I mean, where there's maybe 100 people who want to be improvisers, there'd be 1,000 people who wanted to be a movie actor. So, for like 2 or 3 or 5 years, I was just auditioning all the time. And you can't do anything else, at least me, because of dyslexia. You know, I just had to concentrate on learning the lines for the audition, which is not, they don't give you time. It's, you know, you have to audition tomorrow. Yikes, that was, but finally, I would just, finally, after about 5 years, I was well known enough to just get the call, either, you know, would Larry be available, which that's what you want.
Do you remember when you came in to audition for us?
Yeah.
There was a box of raisins on the coffee table. Did you, by any chance, take them with you when you left?
What are you talking about?
Well, we were all eating the raisins, and I remember you were eating some of the raisins, and then you left, and the raisins were gone. And I was just wondering if, you know, maybe you took them with you.
Are you accusing me of stealing the raisins?
Oh, no, no,
now,
no.
Now, why would I steal a box of raisins?
No, you wouldn't. Nobody would, you know. It's just that they were missing, and, well, I'm just inquiring.
Let me give you a word of advice, okay? I want you to stay away from me. I don't want to talk to you. And I don't want to hear any more of your stupid little notes and suggestions. I don't like you. So if you got any other problems, whether it's raisins, prunes, figs, or any other dried fruit, just keep it to yourself and stay out of my way, okay?
All right. I don't think we're going to have any problem with that. Good talking to you.
That's the great. Well, it's just luck, man.
Because again, what we've been talking about is that you have that comedic background. But one thing about you that sets you apart, and this is why it's been an honor to talk to you, is that having somebody who's been in everything like that, that can play different roles but play it subtly, that you can play such a straight role if you need to. But you could also be the goofy guy, like, you know, you with the raisins with as Kramer and the Seinfeld pilot and stuff. You can be the goofy guy and pratfall and do what you need to do. But then you can also be very stoic and be kind of the background guy that makes the scene continue. And that's so valuable in Hollywood because, again, like you said, every one of these actors went down to Hollywood because they want to be an A-list star. And they want to be in the movies and everything. And you were just like, I'm a working actor. Give me a role. I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll learn it. I'll do what I can. And it's such a great mentality for somebody who was on the road for all those years before then, wondering what your next paycheck's going to be like, wondering where the meal's going to be, what hotel are we going to stay in, or if I'm going to have to sleep on a couch somewhere. A lot of that plays into that role that by the time you end up becoming an actor, it seems like you're like, I'm taking on all comers right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was never my reason. My reason was there's a lot of money to be made here. That was, in other words, but it was not the greed for money. It was the need for money. I mean, I wasn't getting paid enough because Hollywood is very expensive to rent
mm-hmm.
an apartment permanently and then go on auditions for years. So you had to keep the money coming in, or, you know, go home to the East Coast and get a job. I mean, that
be a longshoreman. Yeah. Do something like that. Do you want to do that or stay out here?
I couldn't handle it.
No, but that's you've worked honestly with everybody. And one thing I love about this conversation is that we're talking about the early days, like, because I think a lot of people would want to talk to Larry Hank and say, talk to us about Friends. What was it like dealing with Matthew Perry? What was it like? I'm like, for me personally, I'm not that interested in that. And for you, it seems like you did a lot of this as a job. Like, you didn't necessarily establish that you were best friends. Like, oh, yeah, I was on the set with me and Matthew Perry. We hung out all the time. It's like, no, you're basically you're like, yeah, now I worked with him. Yeah, he's a nice guy or bad guy, whatever the case is. You treated this as more of a job as opposed to some people make it believe it's a lot more of like a what we call influencers nowadays. It's my passion. I'm doing this. You're like, no, it's not. My passion is my work. That's what I'm doing. And I'm doing work.
Well, exactly. I think there's a lot of actors who do that, but they're not well known, you know, because of that. And like I say, my intent was just get the rent paid. I need another job because I get the rent paid. And if I audition and got the job, it didn't matter what the job was. It was a job that's going to pay my rent. And you have no idea what a driving force that is, or maybe you do. There are a lot of people who understand that.
Gig work, yeah, oh yeah.
The rent. That's it. I don't care. And I can stomach this part. There's a lot of times and I go, why am I doing this? Why am I standing here? Why am I saying these words? Because I need the rent. Boom. Okay. Got it. Very, very simple. And to be a star, that doesn't work. You can't be a star because you need the rent. You have to have a burning passion to understand the needs of a manager who will make you a star or put you in a position so that you can make yourself a star. But you need another person. And we actors who consider it a job don't have the manager or the agent for stardom. We have an agent or a manager for paying the rent. And I never realized, because I was very naive. I still am, but at least I know something. I never understood the difference between having a job and being a star. And they're two different tracks. I mean, it's like two different jobs. It's like, you know, being a waiter and being a chef. I mean, if you want to be a waiter all your life, because it pays the rent, and you're a good waiter, like you're one of the best, or a maitre d', and still, it's not being a head chef. I mean, you got to want to be a head chef, boy. You want to be a star, and you have to have the internal fortitude. It's no kidding around. Being a star is not. I've tried it because they didn't understand. So I kept on not making it, or, you know, but trying it, at least getting a foot in the door, was really hard. I mean, the phone calls you have to make and answer, and the people you have to schmooze, and you have to be, I'm not a guy to hang around with, you know. keep to myself. So I wasn't either brought up to be a schmoozer, and you have to really like people, even if you don't like some of your fans because they're bothering you. But you have to be a people person, and I'm not. I just think, but
yeah, well, because you've seen what people do. They bring a beer bottle and want you to get off the stage.
Well, yeah, and that guy with a beer bottle is, in a weird kind of quirky way, is like the guy with the green light who's going to make you a star. And also, in other words, make me laugh or get off the stage. And I don't like what you're doing. You say, you're not going to be a star. And he doesn't like what you're doing. Go argue.
Do you find different stages? It's just these are closed sets and you don't have to deal with these jackasses.
Yeah, and then every once in a while I get a hint because somebody in the company that I'm working for, doing the acting job, recognizes me and thinks I'm very talented. So they treat me well on this, you know, hey, can I get you some water? Hey, why don't you sit here? Hey, you don't have to be around. You're not up for another 2 hours. So, you can't expect it. But every once in a while, I get a star treatment. So I see, oh, this is what it must be like. But you don't have the part to carry it all the way through. You're a character actor, you know. And so that doesn't continue.
Yeah, well, I mean, but a lot of these stories and everything that you can read in Larry's book, which is great. And you got, of course, the follow up.
Let me just say something about the book.
Yeah,
the book is called That Guy, but it's on Amazon and you can buy it. It's to me, it's very expensive. It's $28. I don't buy books, so I don't push it because I don't want anybody who is my fans to think that I'm making $1 million. No, it's not a big seller. It was in the beginning because on Amazon, it's gotten 4.4 out of 5 stars, which is huge. It's just that everybody gives it, who reads it, very high marks, but there's not a lot of sales. So what I did was I made a Kindle book. So
okay. That's
about $10. It's the same book. But if you buy it on Amazon, a Kindle book, it's $10 and it's worth it. Then it's worth it. It's really great. Because do you hear that? I don't want to answer it. I don't.
No, you're good. No, we're wrapping up here now. I've taken plenty of your time.
Okay, so Kindle. But I'm coming out with another book called Loopholes, and that's just on Kindle. $10.
Yeah, okay. I'm looking forward to checking that out because you have definitely that creative itch for all those years with the committee and Second City and being a comic that you had to kind of, going back to what I was saying at the beginning of the conversation, is that you had all these times of, this is what your script is, this is what you have to read. Now you finally have that opportunity to relax. Like you said, you're playing guitar and you could be creative again. And now that with the internet and with Amazon and with YouTube and all of these other options, that gets your opportunity to get out there and be creative and not be beholden to, I guess, the gatekeepers of back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great trip. It was, you know, that's how I look at it. And I put it all in the book. I mean, that's why I wrote the book. All these stories that we've been talking about, well, I fill them out and I tell you the backstory of each one. Not the working of it, but how it was made and who allowed me to do it. And like there's a story about John Huston, which I'm not going to get into, but I worked for John Huston and Annie. And he's a, and I talk just about him. I don't talk about me, but he's a trip, man.
Mm-hmm.
He's the great man. That's all I got to say. He's my hero. And I tell you why. He's just amazing.
And that's why it's a great way to get people to go check out the book. And again, if you don't want to buy it for $28, go on Kindle and go check out That Guy, A Cautionary Memoir by my guest this week, Larry Hankin, and all the other stories. So for anybody who stumbled upon this, they're like, I wanted to hear more stories about Billy Madison. I wanted to hear this. Well, then go read it in the book. Go check that out. That's part of it. It's all a plug. That's what we do. I'm breaking the fourth wall of podcasting here. We give a couple of stories, and then we say, you want more stories? Here, go check out the book. And you also have a website as well and other places. Where can we check out all things Larry Hankin?
Well, you see there's my paintings. I got about 40 of them up on a thing called TheRealLarryHankin.com. And that's where I sell those. I mean, forget the prices. Whatever you want to pay for them. I had a friend put the prices up. So yeah, they're like $400, $500. I mean, forget that. I don't care. No, just 10 bucks. I mean, because they come in different sizes. That size is $400. But
okay,
for that size, if they're about this size, you know, then they're $100 or $50 or $25. Yeah, they're prints. They're not paintings. They're prints. So TheRealLarryHankin.com.
Excellent.
And also, are you on, what is it, Patreon?
I'm on Patreon, yes.
Me too. It's patreon.larryhankin or /. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, look,
I'll put
up
that in the notes for people
That's
who want to check that out.
Videos. I make film shorts. So all my film shorts are on Patreon.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes. And yeah, and if you folks want to follow me on Patreon, patreon.com/Tony Mazur. And yeah, this podcast is going to go out every Wednesday, including this Wednesday that you get to hear this. Larry, thanks so much for joining the show and being on this podcast. And good luck with the books, plural, and the website and everything. And enjoy your slow retirement here as you start to kind of really do enjoy and absorb the journey that you've been on.
Thank you very much. Yeah, you too. Have a great journey in podcasting, okay? Mr. Mazur, right?
Mazur, yes. Yes, Mazur. Absolutely. Yeah. Cool. Thank you so much, Larry. And thank you, folks, for listening.